Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. We're also on BitChute and YouTube. You'll find the links in the podcast description. I'm also a podcasting coach because I've got four other podcasts, meditation podcasts to help you chill, crypto to tell you all about blockchain technology, learn Polish, and the awakening, exposing fraud and corruption, but with solutions. You'll find everything on bio.link/podcaster. My guest today, California, USA, also a multiple podcaster. Entrepreneur, author, speaker, angel investor, former venture capitalist, and co-founder of File Finder. Please welcome Brandon White.
Roy, thanks for having me. I don't know who you just introduced. Is there another guest?
No, I mean, like I've given the bullet points, but you might just introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners.
Well, you did a good job. A repeat entrepreneur who just likes building things and solving problems for people. And that's sort of been my either curse or gift, depending on how you see it, my whole life. So that's what I've been doing. And I've been lucky enough to, all depends on how you keep score, but I've had three exits and one of them was more of a save. So I basically sold it so I would lose less money, but and that does happen. And I've, you know, missed and struck out about 20 times and, I keep on going. I think that trying to build stuff and solve problems for people is fun. And obviously, Roy, I like making money. So, I try to keep doing that.
Brilliant. I suppose like before we kind of delve into your speaking career, like what you've just, you know, mentioned, you know, struck out and things that didn't work. I mean, for me, I'm kind of very open when I'm talking to people, and you know, a lot of businesses, yeah, some sold on and others just run their course, you know, done property stuff for 10 years and then just, yeah, it's kind of, but a load of times when you tell people about that, then you'll hear their horror stories. But a lot of people, they kind of put it in their back pocket and they don't want you to know. And then people, when they hear that, they think, oh, there's something wrong with them. They tried something three times and it wasn't successful. They shouldn't be an entrepreneur. But the reality is most entrepreneurs that you know have tried 20 times plus before they get a success.
Yeah, I think at least in the United States, this world where people use failure, and I don't think it's failing. We don't. I'm going to use baseball, and I know some of your listeners are from Europe, so you'll just have to.
Well, more than half are from the U.S., so you're good.
Okay. So you'll have to bear with the American slant here, but when a baseball player strikes out at the plate, which happens a lot, they don't say he failed. He just struck out. He'll be back at the plate. And for some reason, in some places, people say, oh, well, that person did some business and they failed. They didn't fail. They stepped up to the plate. They got some pitches. They didn't hit that one. And you're going to get another step up to the plate. And I think failure has a very negative connotation for people in the sense as if, oh, you failed, you're going to be in the corner now and you're going to wear the dunce hat or something. And I don't think that's really true. And I tend, for better or for worse, Roy, to want to tell people the truth, because I think very, very early in my career, I would see the magazine article that dates me a little bit, but or the thing on the news or whatever, and it appeared to be some overnight success. And the truth of the matter is that when you peel behind the curtains of almost anyone who has achieved any level of great success, it's not this overnight success. It's years. It's, you know, missing a bunch before you get there. And it's just, I mean, if you think about statistics, it's just the odds aren't that you're going to hit it on the first one. So why would anybody think? Now you can, you know, I managed to, the first company I started when I was out of working on my master's degree, which became an internet company, which I eventually sold. But it wasn't like that story isn't the story. I mean, you read the beginning of my book in that story, but I didn't write the whole story. But, you know, the dot-com crashed. We went bankrupt. I had to buy the company back from investors, put a bunch of money together again to get that company back up and running. But sometimes that story doesn't sell well. So you hear these things. But I think for people, I would rather tell you the truth then you set an expectation because of a picture that you have, and then it not be that way, and you quit because you think that that's not what happens. And yes, like, you use the motivation axis to get people going and excited, but excited doesn't last forever. I mean, you be motivated, and as soon as that motivation, that level of motivation on that scale falls, the behavior, whatever that behavior is, starting a company, whatever you're doing, running a mile, riding a century on your bike, you'll quit. So you've got to have some semblance of making it easy, or at least easy to understand that it wasn't that easy to do. And that's what's going to keep you going. So I tend to be pretty open with it. I also would admit to you, Roy, that maybe that just comes with age. And you get older and you're like, hey, this is life and this is the way it happens. And I would rather tell other people that, so that when they do face that obstacle, and you will face an obstacle in some way or another, that you understand that that is normal, that it's not this smooth sailing of, oh, we just skyrocketed, made $1 billion, cashed out and got our G8.
With people then supporting you, because, like, I presume being an entrepreneur, when you see somebody, you know, maybe opening in a restaurant or whatever their business, you'd kind of give them thumbs up, subscribe, give them a 5-star, whatever it is, the different things that you would do to support them. But that's not the norm. The norm is people are kind of, and I've heard this from a few people, a lot of people are actually watching you to fail. They don't support you at all. People that you would assume would be have your back.
Well, because I know you have a very honest podcast, Roy, we're going to talk some real stuff. Most of the people that do that are insecure themselves and want you to fail, because if you fail, it makes them feel better. It's actually not about you. It comes out as it's about you, and you receive that message that they're really rooting against you. What they're only rooting against you is because they have self-doubt, and if you succeed, then it then forces them, whether they know you or you're in their local town or whatever that is, and they have to see it, that they then have to face their reality that they did not take that risk, that chance to do it. And I'm convinced that more often than not, mostly 99.9% of the time, that is what that negativity is about. So if that helps remind you what it will do and what it has done for me, and you know this as an entrepreneur, Roy, there's going to be 100 people who tell you can't do it. There's going to be people rooting against you, and the odds are against you in general. So you have like all of these things that are just building up, is that it allows you to change your lens, and the lens meaning that as soon as someone says that, instead of receiving it, getting defensive or getting depressed or whatever, letting it affect you at a high level, it always affects us, is to say, that lens looks at that person and says, huh, it looks like they're struggling. So this is probably just them projecting their lack of success or lack of confidence to take, or not even confidence, courage to take that risk on me. So, and then you see that and you don't feel sorry for it, but you understand it more, and it allows you to move on. I mean, every piece of negativity that comes at you from somewhere else is going to affect you. You just have to figure out how to handle that.
Beautiful, beautiful. So with your speaking career, because like, I'd like to know your full journey, how you got comfortable speaking, but then bringing it into the business realm as well, because not only sometimes you're speaking with your employees, but you know, you might be at an event and a stage.
I think I mean, if I'm being totally honest, Roy, I think I like the attention. So, ironically, I'm an introvert. So people mistake introvert and extrovert as meaning how they interact with people and things like that. It's actually about energy levels. So I'm very good in general in front of people. I enjoy the interaction, but at the end of the day, I am totally dead. I we did two recordings yesterday, a podcast, and I'm done because it sucks the energy out of me, where my wife is an extrovert and she's getting energy from being around people. So you could imagine my poor wife when I'm done at the end of the day and she wants to talk and I'm basically don't want to say a single word to anyone for, you know, at least 8 hours. But I really do like the attention and I like helping people. And that turned out to be the way that it happened. And in many ways, Roy, I started my career on the internet in 1996 and it was just by chance. I mean, I was going to build a fishing magazine and didn't have enough money in my bank account to print a magazine on the first run. And there was this thing called the internet. And I had this crazy idea that I could put a magazine on the internet. And for listeners, they're saying, well, that happens all the time now, Brandon. Well, in 1996, it didn't happen all the time. In 1996, the internet was very small. I would argue that 65 or 75% of the internet was America Online at the time. And they, you know, you really didn't have those sorts of, they had content and things, but it was more navigating to small web pages, news and things like that. So I had this idea, and what that did without me really knowing is that I had to be this quote unquote celebrity of this site, which means that I had to be in front of people. And I was in front of people on bulletin boards. I was in front of people in articles. I was in front of people talking, because back then, and still to this day, I would argue, talking, doing seminars, giving talks, and doing those types of things was how you spread the word. And I actually used to do fishing shows on some major networks, like our shows were on ESPN, and they were at the time when they did fishing back then, and Sportsman Network here in the United States and places like that. I actually was on a radio show in England, Martin, name will come to me, Roy, but it was called At the Water's Edge. All these things are speaking events, basically. Now, speaking on the big stage is definitely can be a little bit different, mainly because you actually see the 1,000 people that are, or whatever the audience is. You know, I've spoken in front of from 5 people. I taught 11 kids the other night how to build a business plan, high school kids here in Half Moon Bay, how to build a business plan. And, you know, that was 11. But I was at the Direct Sellers annual convention doing a talk on the big stage. And, you know, there's 1,000 people there. So, and TV, there's hundreds of thousands, if not a million people. So, but all you're really looking at is the camera. So you can't let that go to your head. And I just did it out of necessity. And then I just sort of liked it. I do want to say, Roy, that doesn't mean that I don't get, I wouldn't say scared, but anxious. I mean, walking, when you're behind the big stage and you have hundreds or thousands of people out front there, it's a little daunting, because you are the central focus of all those people for that moment, however long you're giving a talk. And, you know, that can produce some anxiety. By the same token, for me, it's also some sense of excitement. So I try to take that anxiety, and I channel it into excitement, and I acknowledge it and say, hey, of course I'm going to have a little anxiety. There's 1,000 people out there and there's going to be a spotlight on me. And this is broadcast all over the place. Like, you know, don't mess this up. And then by the same token, it's like, oh my God, there's going to be 1,000 people out there. It's going to be broadcast all over the place. What a great opportunity. This is exciting. And then you just go. So, that's how I learned to do it. And that was probably a longer answer to your question. But
no,
that's
but I love that. Reframe it in your head. Instead of looking at the negative, look at the positive. Brilliant. And with the different companies, like hiring then, because that tends to be a problem for a lot of entrepreneurs, hiring the right people. Have you tips on that?
Yeah, hiring is a really tough one. Luckily, most of my career has been with engineers, software engineers, and we just learned with software engineers that we were going to put them through actual live tests. And we do put them through live tests, meaning we do talk to them first. we do a short exercise on seeing their code from somewhere else, that if they don't have code on something like GitHub or something like that, then it's a red flag for us or GitLab. Doesn't matter the site. There's people commit code to these code repositories. And then ultimately, if we feel like they're a fit culturally for the company, we do an hour to an hour and a half live coding session where we may say, hey, Roy, build tic-tac-toe. We are right now in front of us and we watch, and we're not watching necessarily. What we're really looking for is what's the approach? What's their thought process? How are they tackling this? What language are they writing it in? Not that the language would be right or wrong. It would be, tell us why you chose that, because that's what matters in that process. So that's for a software engineer. For people, I'd have to look it up. I don't have it in front of me. I could name a few. I have 10 principles that, or 12, it grows sometimes, that I'm basically looking for. And I don't, and I would suggest that anyone listening to this who hires people, do not hire someone after an interview. Someone sitting across the table from you in a planned event is not who they really are. I'm not saying that you don't get inklings of who they are. I'm just saying they prepared to come into that interview, that it is a framework of which is almost somewhat controlled, of which they plan for. I tend to want to have conversations with people over time. Now, if you're growing fast, someone could say, well, that's problematic. Well, what's more problematic is hiring the wrong person and having to replace them after you just ramped them up, recruited them, got them integrated into your company, and now you have to let them go. The cost of that to your business far outweighs any of the upfront work that you should do. So I generally have conversations and I don't do interviews. I mean, I'll eat lunch with someone, Roy, but I'm more apt to go hiking, biking, or something else if we can with them. If it's remote, I have some people who have worked, we've worked together for 10 years and I've never met in person in another country. Those people I'm just going to keep having conversations with, whether it's video conversations or get them integrated into some Slack channel. And then you're going to see over time. And I would argue that if you do interview someone, you need to make it a really long interview, because the first hour, everybody is on guard and they can keep track of what they're doing. Oh, don't make this hand gesture. Oh, sit up straight. Keep eye contact. Well, after 60 minutes, that gets hard. So I tend to do longer things. Some of those traits that I mentioned would be bias towards action. So they're going to want to make decisions, willing to talk or speak up and voice their opinion if they don't agree. If they don't agree, but the consensus is that we are going to do something against what they do, that they actually fall in line and take the team effort and don't say, I told you so. There's a whole list of things. So I go through and try to check those check boxes. And ideally someone would have every one. If they get every one, I found that generally it works out. If it doesn't work out, you know, maybe it's some extraordinary thing that happened to them or us or whatever it is. But that's my process. And I guess the takeaway there is really have conversations with people, not interviews, and call their references. Most people don't call their references. And if they give you three references, ask for five, because it's really the last two that you want to talk to, not the first three.
Or another one is when you ask the reference, when you're talking to the person, just saying, who else is did he report to? Because they'll always give you a friend. And then when you get that person, you're getting a different conversation.
Exactly. That's a great tip. And one that I need to write down and use, because it is that, and they will do that because they're not on guard.
Exactly.
They're just trying to help you. So I really do think, and I've been guilty of it, is, oh, I really like this person, I'm not going to call their references. And more often than not, the references are, even if they don't get you to a no, they're going to give you some context that at least you have an expectation about.
Another thing that I do as well is the receptionist, see how they treated them, because sometimes if they've got ego or anything, they look down on them and you'll spot it a mile away. And you've mentioned about going for a meal. I love doing that. That's when you see them dropping their guard, because if you see them treating a waiter bad, or just, you know, simple thing. You'll pick up so much stuff. They drop their guard when they're eating.
They definitely drop their guard when they're eating, and they'll even drop their guard more when they're under some physical duress. So if you go biking with them and things change, you got to pay attention to the road, or you go hiking, or you go on a long walk. You know, better to do a walking meeting than sit down at a desk. You got to watch traffic. You're looking, you know, they're distracted. They're seeing nature. It changes people. And that it's not to trick someone. It's that you're just trying to actually get to know their true self, not the self that they've produced to get the job. And I'm not saying that's bad. That's fine. I mean, that's definitely a good thing to understand too. Like, did the person come in a t-shirt or did they come in a collared shirt? Those sorts of things matter. I also, to be honest with you, Roy, I want to see what their car looks like. Not because I want to see what model car they have. I want to see how messy or neat it is. Because you can tell a lot about a person by their car. You can tell, and I know these are generalizations, but...
No, you're dead right. It's something I watch out for as well. You're dead right.
Yeah, I mean, you got it. If somebody's car is a mess and they tell you that they're organized, that's an interesting circumstance to understand. Like, you know, and I would ask, well, if you're so organized, why is your car a mess? You know, and it's a valid question. So, and do people take care of their things, right? I mean, some people's cars are just filthy mess. And whether, I don't care if you drive a little Pinto's old. I don't have Pintos anymore, Roy, but, you know, a Volkswagen Beetle, for lack of a better thing to say, you know, do you wash it? Does it keep clean? Are you aware that, you know, how do you treat those things? Because how you treat your things is definitely an indication how you're going to treat other people's things. So all these little things that aren't necessarily on that resume. The resume is interesting, but the resume doesn't tell the whole story.
I know you mentioned maybe going for a cycling or whatever, but with me, I've seen it in golf and even in squash. You just see people cheating and just counting wrong and everything. And it's just a red flag for me. It's like, yeah, I don't. Or even if it's like, say, if you're going to go into business with somebody and you decide to go for a game of golf and you just see how they're doing. Because, I mean, you know, when it's a 4 or a 5 or whatever. And when they're, I saw one guy putting a tee up in the sand when, thinking nobody saw him. Like, and it's just like, if he's doing that, it's showing you what they're really like.
Yeah, and they don't, and even when you're aware of it, it's hard to not do those things, like your true self to come out, and because they don't, it just, and that's what a change of scenery will do. I mean, you can literally take someone in a, if you're under some sort of constraint where you know, people are saying, hey, Brandon and Roy, that's really cool. You guys are entrepreneurs. You can take walks and stuff, but I can't do that in my setting. Okay. Well, have them come into the conference room, but halfway through the meeting, move where you're talking, go to the cafeteria, go outside. And as soon as that change of venue happens, you will get a different version of that person because now you've put some variable that was not predicted into it, and they're going to worry about that, which is going to open the door to a bunch of other things. And sometimes it's for the better. Sometimes you'll come into someone and you're like, oh my God, like this isn't going to work. And then you go sit outside under a tree at a picnic table or something and have a soda or a coffee or tea or something. And you're like, oh my God, this person is so much better. They were they were having anxiety and that wasn't their true self. So this isn't all negative. This is actually positive things.
Yeah, because a lot of people, you know, they fear public speaking and in turn interview. I remember, I mean, I got to a stage where an interview wasn't a problem, but when the earlier ones, I used to be terrified. So how could I be my true self when I'm shaking going into the place?
Yeah, and I think the thing is, you know, you're going to be scared doing things for sure. It's not that I'm not scared to build companies, to go in front of on stages or talk on podcasts are pretty easy for me, to be honest with you now. But you know, it can be daunting for, for some people to do that. I mean, we have a studio, and people come into the studio and they're actually sometimes shaking before they come in. So I'm like, hey, our studio is in the back of my yard of my house. I built it actually. And I'll say, hey, let's go, to the quote unquote green room, which is my kitchen in my house, and hang out for a minute and basically do that, because you are going to have that level of fear when you do things that are risky or outside your comfort zone. It's courage that actually gets you there. So, courage is doing things that you're scared of doing, but you do anyway. And I think that's the main thing to understand. It's sort of my whole thing, understand what's happening behind the curtain, Roy, which is even the most successful people can be scared or have anxiety. They just do it anyway. And once you do that, you actually create this reinforcement circle that makes you stronger. Because every time that anxiety happens, you actually remember and associate the success, as long as you have it. And then you can use that as a trigger to harness your energy. So there's all these little tricks psychology-wise, I think, that you can use to do these things.
And with the psychology, because I know you've got a master's in that, did you find that helped with business and how you kind of understand people?
Yeah, it's interesting. They asked me that question the other night. I had 11 high school kids that I'm teaching how to build business class to high school kids, because I think that kids in high school, if I would have had that class, they didn't even teach it to me in college, but they have that class, they would open up some ideas for them. But they asked me that. And I think the psychology degree, my answer is, and it was and is, that business is about people. The numbers have to work. Make no mistake. You've got to understand spreadsheets, and you've got to understand at least some level, or have a partner who understands them deeply, because business is about numbers and it's about making money. Like, let's not sugarcoat it. If you don't make money, you can't stay in business. But how those numbers work and how those numbers are implemented and how things get done is with people. So psychology really helped me, definitely, probably more so. You hate to rate things, right? But I have an MBA as well. And my MBA was great. Met great people, learned great things, got to travel around the world and see businesses and things like that. But at the heart of it was all people. So I think that psychology definitely, I weigh that heavier, but it's the combination of both of them. But if you can't like be good with people, know how to interact with people, know how to speak, I'm not saying you need to be able to speak on stage, but you do need to be able to speak. And I don't know about you, Roy, but, and we talked before we jumped on here a little bit about writing. And I know you write books and you have some books, and maybe one that should be published that you're thinking about published behind you. But the writing is like speaking too. You need to be able to write, and you need to be able to speak, because whether we like it or not, until Elon Musk gets the chip in our brain, which could happen sooner than we think, you need to express yourself. And how you express yourself is how people will receive you, for better or for worse. And you really need to be able, at some level, to be able to articulate things and to be able to write, because writing is as important. Writing is part of psychology. You need to have enough self-awareness to read an email and understand the lens of which that other person is going to receive it. And if it's not, if the words are terse or sharp or whatever they are, then have self-awareness enough to know that you need to rewrite that and change that. So I think psychology is at the heart of everything we do, whether that's business, relationships, everything.
Excellent. So I see you've got a beautiful studio there, and you've taught me, because I have 5 podcasts, but I count it 8. Is it 8 that you have in total, or what's
your... To be honest with you, I think it's 8, but I don't actually know. I'd have to go and count.
Well, I found 8 anyway, so there's definitely 8. So.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to find them. Yeah, I've done 8 podcasts. It didn't turn out that way. I think what I found, which I'll share with listeners, because maybe some listeners are thinking about doing a podcast or wondering about that sort of stuff is that I think this is a good lesson in business, actually, Roy. And I can relate it to how I adjusted my business is if you're going, be specific so people know what you are or who you are. Those podcasts that you found are very niche specific. They're marketing, productivity. I think I have a 401k. I have a mortgage rate daily one.
The lawyer one as well, I think.
Oh, the car accident lawyer one. I did that because my mom got into an accident. It really bothered me that someone hit someone and then you're affected for your entire life health-wise. My mom's okay, but she did have occasionally a neck issue that you're not compensated. So that was that. I have the Brandon White show, which is the main show that really started it all. And then maybe I have a fishing one. I brought it back. I started that podcast in 1997. We used to call it audio blogging back then. And I actually brought it back. I had the original podcast that was put on iTunes in 2004 or 2005. I forget. And then I lost a lot of the episodes, but I brought that back. So it's a fishing reports podcast for the United States East Coast. But each one of those is specific. And I think it was a lesson that I learned when I did my first company, which I've alluded to a few times, which was a fishing website. And I built what became the largest social networking site for sport fishermen on the internet. And it was a social networking and e-commerce site. And one of the things that we did when I started was I started with my original region, which was the Chesapeake Bay, which is on the east coast of the United States. And it is several states are around it, and districts, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, part of Delaware, actually Pennsylvania, the Susquehanna River. And I set out to basically cover that area and be that area. So when someone came to that site was originally called Chesapeake Angler, everybody knew that it was about the Chesapeake. I didn't have to explain much. I, in my air quotes for people not watching, infinite wisdom, wanted to be bigger, greater, better, and renamed it Worldwide Angler with the idea that we could take that template and punch it out across the United States and across the world in some of the bigger fishing destinations, like in general, Europe, Australia, Asia. And we expanded fast. We raised money and we never did the other regions as well as we did that Chesapeake region, because that was really the home region. And to be quite honest, we really had never finished the Chesapeake region in covering it, meaning there was a plenty big enough market there to do it. And there was plenty of money to be made, but for whatever reason, I wanted to expand and be greater and be bigger and all those things. Well, then what happened was, is with Worldwide Angler is that that's a cool brand and it was a cool site, but it wasn't personal to that person's region necessarily. So there wasn't as much relationship with that brand. Yes, you could get information around the world, but most people fish regionally. Yes, you travel to go fishing, but how often does that happen? Does that support a community around that? And when I bought it back, when the internet crashed, I bought it back from the investors, I renamed it Tuttle Fish and went back to the Chesapeake region. And I said to myself, I'm not going to make that mistake again. I'm going to be extremely focused on this region. I'm going to own this region and really own it, meaning just be the best that there is and not allow other people to be able to come into my market necessarily and overthrow me or anything. And my theory was one, was there was plenty of money to be made in that region. Two is, as an exit strategy, I thought that at some point someone would want to do a roll up with the best of class, because maybe when I did that last site, I should have done a roll up, and I did buy one company, but should have maybe continued that versus trying to build out these regions, is that someone was going to have to buy it. It turns out that that's what happened. Somebody wanted to do a roll up, a public media company, and they had to buy our site. That bringing it back to the podcast is that when you have a show, if you have a show that just is an entertainment show, so the Brandon White show has just guests that Brandon is interested in having, and that's really the draw. But people have to understand that Otherwise, if they don't understand that me, in this case, that person, then it becomes confusing. So I just spun out podcasts that were very specific to those niches. And it turns out that that works better. So that's really how all these podcasts came. I do find myself in recording mode a lot, but it's interesting to see what happens. And also, Roy, I would tell you that it's also an experiment. We'll see which one catches on. If one never catches on, we'll just kill it.
Do you have the co-host one as well, the angel investor with Daniela? Is that your?
Yep. So it used to be called On Business with Danielle Jenkins. I met Danielle on the show. Danielle is an incredible woman who started a cleaning company in Canada from nothing. She literally did not, Roy, have enough money to buy a candy bar one day. That's how broke she was. And she put some flyers out and started a home cleaning company that now does several million dollars, is profitable. She lives on a home on a golf course in Canada. She's not 30 years old. She's 28 years old. And I had done a show with her on my main show. And just getting to know her, I think that conversation was 2.5 hours on that show. I was like, you know what? You know, people would like to hear you. I think we could do a podcast. She didn't want to do a podcast wasn't even on the radar. So I was like, hey, why don't you come on regularly and let's just talk about business together, what it's like running a business, because she's a woman running a cleaning company and I'm a tech dude in the Valley. She's younger than I am. And it would be a good contrast, right? It'd be a good discussion. And we did a show every Friday. And then I said, you know, let's spin out our own podcast. We used to call it On Business. Now it's called the Danielle and Brandon Show. And it's basically a conversation of business owners. And we just talk about business, like the real truth, how hard it is, what happened, real lessons. So for business owners out there. So yeah, you did find you did a lot of research, Roy.
And what I like is, because sometimes you see co-hosts and one hogs the stage or whatever, but it seems to work. He seems to have a good dynamic. And you know, I just listened to a few parts of it now, and it was actually nice to the way that you're doing it.
Yeah, I'd rather Danielle take the spotlight, then she can talk and I don't have to. But it's really designed to be a conversation, and she and I get along, and it's an interesting discussion. I think we would both be lying to say that we both get something out of each episode too, because we're learning and the audience gets to learn too. So I think we renamed that show, which sometimes happens, because we wanted a little bit more leeway on the topics and not to have to keep giving, here's the six tips of the six software apps that we use all the time, right? Which is useful. But we wanted it to be more of a conversation. So we just changed it and we're getting back into the swing of things. I think that show has 42 episodes. So it's not a, you know, it's a decent podcast. I mean, trying to do, as you know, Roy, 42 episodes consistently is hard. So yeah, and I'm grateful for you bringing it up and finding it. She's a great co-host and it's been really fun. And I've learned a lot from her. I mean, imagine being broke, printing flyers and starting a home cleaning business that does now 5 years, I think it's been 5 years later, does like millions of dollars in revenue and is profitable. I mean, that's just inspiring.
Brilliant. No, it's fantastic. So I've read your book. It's been released soon. I'm just trying to find the name. It's Back of the Napkin to Business Plan in 11 Slides, is this? Is that the correct title?
That's right. So easy, you can do it on a flight from San Francisco to New York.
So you might, I mean, I like, you can touch on kind of the different things, but one thing that I actually liked was the elevator pitch. And you gave an example of that, because I think everybody's kind of hears at the elevator pitch, but you've done it in such a good way that I've never seen it before. So perhaps you kind of, we delve into part of the book.
Yeah, I'm grateful. I had some anxiety myself, Roy, when I filled out your podcast sheet and you said, send me your book. I read 100 books a year and I will read your book. And I was like, oh my God. this guy's going to read the book. So we're going to see what type of feedback we get. And I'm so grateful for your kind words. So I did do the elevator pitch. And I think where people get that elevator pitch wrong is people on the internet suggest that an elevator pitch is a minute or 45 seconds. I actually violently disagree. I think that if you don't have your elevator pitch in less than 10 seconds, that you are basically in a lot of trouble. And I do want to preface it by saying that getting your elevator pitch correct is very hard. It will take a long, it can take a very long time, and it will require an enormous amount of practice and failure or rejection from people. And you need that feedback to get there. But I basically broke it down in a formula that says you've got to be able to engage someone to fix their problem. We talked earlier about this, about when you brought up people who, you know, are always saying negative things. It's really, and we talked about it, it's about them. The fact of the matter is the world is like that, Roy. We all want to talk about ourselves. We all are focused on ourselves. I find it funny. I don't know if you work out, but I go to the gym a lot, and people will say, I'm sure you've heard this, Oh, Roy, I can't go to the gym. I'm very self-conscious and people are looking at me. I got news for you. They're not looking at you. They're looking at themselves in the mirror. That's why there's a mirror. And they may glance at you, but I will promise you, we are all looking at ourselves. And that analogy is how the world works. We are always looking at ourselves. We always want to talk about ourselves. Or if you're a parent, you want to talk about your kids or your grandkids. That's how it works. So you understanding that, nobody wants to hear about you. So I go through in the book, I think I go through a good, an okay, and a bad elevator pitch. So I think I can reproduce that somewhat well. I am an investor and started a company called File Finder. And the elevator pitch is, we help you find files you know you have but can't find faster. That's the elevator pitch. I'm guessing, Roy, that you just heard that. Now, I know you read the book, but you have likely, as a businessman, business person, had that experience of not finding a file that you know that you have.
That's that someone constantly sent
you. Right?
Yeah.
So I have instantly grabbed your attention. I never are, and I would guess that you and listeners would be interested in more. But here's the interesting part about that elevator pitch. I never told you how we do it. I never told you my name. And I never told you why I was qualified to do it. But you're instantly interested. Why? Because it touches on a problem you have, and you have pain. That's exactly what it does. And you need, I hate to tell people what they need to do. You don't need to do it, but I'd suggest your results will not be very good if you don't do this, is get elevator pitches that are that good. A okay elevator pitch would be something to the effect, we help you find files. It would be more like this. Roy, my name's Brandon. I wouldn't even know your name. I'd say, I'm Brandon. I started a company that helps you find files that you can never find. I have a degree in psychology, and I built it that way, in a way that you can find files easier. That's not a perfect, it's actually hard for me to do bad ones, but you can see that it's more, I'm trying to justify why this product you should be interested in by talking about myself. That's not good. First of all, you don't care who I am, right? Second of all, you don't care why I'm really qualified. And a bad one would be something like, oh, my name is Brandon. I've got a company that called File Finder that'll help you find files that you know you have. I started the company because my wife had this problem. And then I hired these super smart engineers, and they're super qualified, Roy. They have masters from all over in computer science, and they're super smart. And I mean, I can look at you right now and your eyes are glazing over, right? Nobody cares. All you care about is, can you help me find files that I know I have, but I can't find in my computer, on my email, et cetera, faster. Then what happens is people say, well, how do you do that? Now you have permission to explain in less than 30 seconds, not go into your whole story about it, how you do it. And once you understand the principle here and that you're really serving that other person, it allows you to get that elevator pitch. I think three mistakes I put in the book is people say their name. Nobody cares. The only person that cares is you. And you say your name because you want to hear your name. You better to ask hey, what is your name? And you say Roy, and I say, Roy, we help you find files you know you have but can't find faster. Now I just even made that elevator pitch stronger. Not about saying anything about my product, but saying your name. So don't say your name. Two is, no one cares why you're qualified unless they ask. But if you solve a problem, nobody asks why you're qualified to do it if you solve the problem. That's the interesting part. I use Sarah Blakely in the book from Spanx only because she is in such stark contrast to a person who would design women's underwear. Effectively, she was selling copiers. She was not qualified at all, other than the fact that she was a woman and did know what the problem was. But I'm saying that as it relates to manufacturing. She had no background in manufacturing. She was a salesperson. No more than Danielle Jenkins, who's my co-host on the Danielle and Brandon show, had any qualification to clean houses other than she probably cleaned her room at that point. I think she was like 21 years old. I mean, nobody asked. All they said was, oh, you can clean my house and it's going to be clean. You know, you can clean it up for X amount of money. She cleaned it and they were excited. They never said, well, how are you qualified? How do you know that? They didn't. So don't say your name. You don't need to say why you're qualified. And the third one in the book I put is that I've seen, and the mistakes that I made, is no one cares about your story. They only care about the story if they ask about your story, and you don't get to tell your story for 5 minutes because you want to hear yourself talk. You have to be really short. My wife had that problem because she was switching accounting firms and it was taking 4 weeks for her to manually go through it, and I wanted to automate it. That's all you need to know. If you want more, the other person will ask. And people want to tell their story because we're all passionate about our stories. That's why podcasts exist, some level, right? Tell other people's, and people like to hear stories. But the idea of an elevator pitch is not that you're in the setting to tell a story. The elevator pitch is something that you can use in your marketing to grab someone's attention. When you're in an elevator, when you're in a business meeting, when you're in a Zoom meeting where you're meeting other people, and that you can instantly get that out. So I have a formula for that, I'm pretty sure, in the book there. And we have worksheets that people can download that can get that. And I will say that if your listeners aren't business people necessarily, but they're just people who work at other companies, you still need an elevator pitch. My elevator pitch, if I was pitching that, is people listen to me because I can help you build a business plan in 11 slides. I didn't tell you my name. I didn't tell you how I was able to learn that. I just told you why people listen to me. And if that resonates with you, then you'd be interested. So it was fun writing the book, Roy. It was extremely hard. Ironically, I've taught 1,500 people. And I give away, just for listeners, I'm not selling a course at all. I actually giving away the course when the book comes out. But I did used to charge for the course. And we had 1,500 students who took that course and they paid a lot of money for that course. I'm giving it away just because I'll be honest with you, I don't want to sell courses in that way. And two is, if it helps someone build a business and follow their dream, then the ROI for me is just as good for someone to write me and say, oh my God, I took that thing and I built this business, and I get to brag about someone taking a course that I designed that they built, you know, a multi-million or billion-dollar business with. So,
brilliant. And I mean, just for those listening, it's like the book is, for me being an entrepreneur, because I mean, I've gone through lots of different, it's actually an actionable book. So it's not just the case of just read this and extract what you get. You're kind of, as you're going through it, you're giving the key points and having places to write down which is the best form of a book for creating the business plan that you will need that will help you succeed.
And it was designed that way. It was not designed to be a 60,000 word book that you don't finish. Be quite honest. You and I were talking about this. Most people actually don't finish books. They don't finish books, or they'll read the first two chapters and go to the end. Now, this may be different with novels. Here we're talking about business books and things like that. But a 60,000 word book is hard. I wanted it to be a book that you literally could. The challenge for me, I think the real challenge was, how short can I make a book that teaches someone how to build a business plan? Because it all stemmed from me and my first business plan, which I won't go into the whole story, but I got a book that was longer than the business plan. It took me like 2 weeks to read the book. And then it taught me how to write a 50,000 page business, 50 page business plan that was dead on arrival. And this allows you to get up to speed fast. And it really, so I think Silicon Valley innovated. This isn't a Brandon idea. I just took all of my experience from being an entrepreneur, whether starting a business. This book can be used where you can start a business, you can launch a new product, you can launch a product in a big business or a new division in a big business. I just took all of my experience in those things, which I've had experience in those things, and distilled it into 11 slides. It used to be 13 slides. And in this challenge to make it even shorter and still convey what you need to convey, I made it 11. And it is a story. It builds on one another and is designed for you to be able to actually do that. And I don't know, didn't take you that long to read the book. You and I were talking yesterday.
Yeah, I read it. This morning I read it. I don't know, but it was between 1 and 2 hours, I suppose. You know, I didn't time it, but it was enjoyable. The fact that I just continued on to it. I mean, that doesn't always happen with a book. So that's compliments to you that it was actually a very enjoyable book.
Yeah. So thank you for that. I'm really grateful that for you reading it. But that was the elevator pitch. And every single, we go through that with just as a teaser, because I do want people to buy the book, of course. It's not that super expensive and probably worth $1 million to you if you build a business with it. But the problem slide, which is person does something, their pain is existing solutions are broken because. I've dumbed it down. I say dumbed it down. I've made it that easy to do that. And that is at the crux of any business. A person does something, the pain they have is existing solutions are broken because. And in those three elements, the pain needs to be high enough or created high enough, meaning like luxury goods, you have to make someone want that Rolex watch because they want that status, so to speak. The pain has to be high enough that they'll pay you enough money that you can make a profit off of that price to run a business. And it really is that simple. I had a lot of this came from just my own experience, Roy. I had a customer who was a fisherman on that fishing website, and I had met him. I did not know who he was. And he said, "Hey, do you want to go fishing on Friday?" This is in the years and two decades ago. And I said, "Yeah." I mean, I was always going fishing, and turns out this guy who I got to fish with every Friday was a very successful real estate man named Chris. And he built his first company and sold it to Merrill Lynch, a real estate company, before he was 32, had a 5-year non-compete, built another real estate company, took it public, and then Warren Buffett bought it. And he sat on the board with Warren Buffett. And I fished with Chris all over the world. We became fast friends, and we would fish locally in Maryland on the Maryland Eastern Shore. And he would also, he still is, he's such a hard driver. He'd be like, "Hey, I've got a river that we can fish today, Brandon." And I'd be like, "Okay, let's go." And we would drive, Roy, 3 hours to go fishing for an hour in this epic river and drive back. And he never stopped. But in these, you know, the drives were always great because, I mean, imagine having someone like that in the car with you for hours at a time. We fished in Honduras, we fished in the Bahamas together and these other places. But one day he said to me, he's like, "Hey, Brandon, you know, you're making business too complicated. It's really simple. You sell a product that solves a pain for someone. You have expenses that are related to that, and they need to be less than what the price you charged for, and then you make a profit. Do that." And, you know, it really got me to think, like, and there are some complexities, you know that, Roy, and listeners listening, that you do know, you do need to understand how to, and it wasn't that he got there without doing this, but he was making a point that I think is important is, yeah, you do have to know what your customer acquisition costs are. You do need to know what your ARPU is. You need to know all of these things that build into that quote unquote income statement or cash flow statement. But at the end of the day, it really is that simple. And that's what I tried to do in the book, to say, get an idea down, put your thoughts down, because everybody has an idea. You do need to put some structure to it, and then get that thing done and go test it.
So I know you were doing venture capital and then angel investor. Some people, they're trying to raise funds. What advice could you give them how to do it properly and not to lose? Because sometimes I see people, you know, they get excited because they get a big check and they give up, you know, majority shareholding when they didn't really need that amount of money as well. So you may just kind of, how they should try to do it as the owner of the company.
Yeah, don't raise money. I'm halfway joking. But here, and I get to say this, and I did work for two venture capital firms early in my career, and I do angel investing to this day. But I think what's happened, and I say this lovingly, because we need venture capital and we need venture capitalists. But what entrepreneurs need to understand is that entrepreneurs are venture capitalists' product. We are their product. They have no business without us, which means they have to market to us. And when they market to us, they market that raising money is the success, right? You hear this all the time online. Oh, was I able to raise money from this VC? As if this VC knows without absolute uncertainty that you're going to be successful, when 1 in 10 venture investments make their fund in general. So if you do get money, I'm just offering you a different perspective, is that 1 in 10 make it. So you're not even batting 300, like in baseball. I keep using baseball, but you're not, like, you have a 10% chance effectively, because 10% of their portfolio makes most of their money for their fund. Let's be generous and say 20%, okay, for those VCs that are listening to this and saying, "Oh, Brandon, blah, blah, blah." So understand that raising money isn't the badge of honor. Building a company that grows and creates wealth. I hesitate to say profitable, because tech companies aren't always profitable out of the gate. Salesforce wasn't profitable, all these companies, for 20 years, but creates wealth. I will say that if your company grows fast, you will need money. That there's little way around that. Whether you're a product company or a service company, you are going to need cash to grow, because you're growing ahead of your revenue and or your revenue collections. And the way that I tell people to raise money is, if you believe that your company is going to grow and need to raise money from investors, an angel investor or a venture capitalist, that type of money, even your bank, quite candidly, go and talk to these people and ask them for advice before you need the money. Because now you're going to approach them as if you're raising money, but you know you're not going to raise the money. Maybe you'll get lucky. But the reason I say this is because what that allows those people to do, and then is track you. Because once you have that meeting with that person and you ask them for advice, which is different than asking for money, it's, "Hey, Roy, I've got this idea. I'm going to build this product that finds files. What do you think about that?" here's what I'm doing. And you got to have some sort of plan, which you can have in these, 11 slides or whatever. And then that person will give you advice, and then you send them updates. And they're probably going to say you're not ready, and you know you're not ready. But what this allows you to do and allows them to see is that you do what you say you are going to do. And that is what's investable. And instead of, and I know this is hard, but I still encourage listeners to do it, is don't go to that person when you need money and tell them what you did. Now, sometimes that works. If you're Instagram or some crazy company, growing just so rapidly that the chart is overwhelming, the evidence is overwhelming. But more often than not, that can be hard to do versus having talked to these people, developed a relationship. This goes back to your question earlier about hiring that you and I talked about. You're not doing an interview in that case. You've had conversations with this person, even if those conversations are only updates of emails that you've sent them of your progress. That is a conversation. It just, and they are thinking something. You may not get to hear that, or maybe they'll answer you or something along the way, but it's start those conversations way, 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 way before they happen. Now, someone could say, well, Brandon, I could go to them and have an idea and it just not work out. That's okay too, because now you've included this potential investor in your story. And they now know that if an idea doesn't work out, you don't freak out or lose your stuff. You do something else, which I don't know about you, Roy, but I would invest in a person who I knew was going to understand if something couldn't work and figure out something new, try to make a return on that investment. So this all goes back to stick your flag in the sand, so to speak, way before you need that money, and have that conversation along the way and give updates. You don't even have to be monthly. It could be quarterly, and touch base with people. If you don't do that, or you're listening to this and say, well, that's all great, but I'm already past that, then have a good deck and buy my book. I hate to say that, because I don't hate to say that at all. Actually, you should buy the book. I've had people who never raised money before follow that plan. And in a pitch deck competition that I saw, that I was speaking at an event in Las Vegas, a big entrepreneur event, this lady raised money for her dog beds. So one of the most important things to know with investors is they have really short attention spans, and they see 100. If they're a good investor, they see hundreds, if not thousands, of deals. So your deal, while your story is important to you and you've put everything on the line and all those sorts of things, you're another deal to them. So how are you going to stand out? And how you're going to stand out is have a good business, of course, but also make it very easy for them to consume. And I've just found that, I don't know where we are on time on your show here, but I think it's worth mentioning. So goes back to your question about what was the most valuable thing was psychology. After I graduated from my MBA, I went and studied with a guy, BJ Fogg from Stanford, which he runs it used to be the Persuasive Computing Lab, and it's now called Behavioral Science Lab or something to that effect. You can look up BJ Fogg. But I got certified in a thing called Tiny Habits, and as a coach or mentor. And he really made it simple, is that if you look at the X and Y axis, so up and down axis, you're going to have motivation, low motivation at the bottom, high motivation at top. And on the horizontal axis, you're going to have hard to do, easy to do. And if you can think of a curve that sort of goes on that graph, as motivation rises, behaviors or habits happen. That can be anything from brushing your teeth to whatever it is, donating money to your alma mater, to starting a company. The problem is that as motivation wanes, behaviors and habits stop. But the interesting thing is the way that curve goes is that as you make it easier, behaviors don't need a lot of motivation to happen. So what that says and has guided me in everything that I have done is make it easy for someone to do, and they will do it without you having to motivate them. Because we all know that if you're, I'm going to use the diet thing, if you want to lose weight, you're going to get super motivated. You're going to watch some movie. You're going to hear some inspiring story. You're going to have a wedding to go to. I don't know what it is. You got to do something or have a wedding. You can be super motivated. And that diet, which I don't think should be, but that's another podcast, that event is going to happen for a minute, but then motivation is going to wane. And then you find yourself back in the old habit. Whereas if you made it easy to eat right, meaning you just got rid of all the junk in your house, you had a fresh supply of good food, you probably would eat that food. And I know you will, because you'll be hungry and that'll be the only thing you can eat and it'll be easy to eat it. And then you will have a lifestyle change. And I think that this goes back to your question, what can you do for investors? You got to make it easy for them to consume and understand your company, which goes back to the elevator pitch, and it goes back to the deck that you build for them. And if it's not my deck, build a deck. I don't care. If you can do it in 9 slides, do it in 9 slides, but make sure you cover the right topics that they're going to want to see. But you got to make it easy. And I'm sure you've seen this, Roy. You see these people who build these decks with 8-point font. I mean, who the hell can read? You actually said this when we got on. You said it, or maybe you said it on the air or off. You said if your book was in, the same book was in small font, in basically walls of words, you probably wouldn't have read it. And so you got to make it easy to consume, which means you got to be able to say things in 32-point font that still conveys your message. And there's probably a bunch of people out there listening to this show right now saying, not possible. And I say possible, and you better do it, because otherwise an investor they're just not going to take the time to read it. They see too many deals, and you've got to make it easy. And I would argue that you got to do that in everything in life, but especially with investors.
I was going to ask you on marketing, but I know that's a podcast in itself. So I have to get you back to go into marketing, because I love all the information that you're sharing today. So Brendan, you might let people know, how can they get in contact with you?
I think the best way is to go to my website, brandoncwhite.com, brandoncwhite.com. It will have, when the book comes out, the book, it has the podcast, it has about me, and it has my contact information. That's my real email on there. Feel free to email me. I am always happy to help people who are willing to work hard and do the work. I probably should always charge for that, but I don't. But feel free to reach out. I'm happy to do that. And I'm so grateful for you having me on the show, Roy. You and I exchanged some messages on Twitter, and I saw your podcast, and I said, well, I'm going to talk to this guy. In fact, I think I was so eager to talk to you that I just booked without us even knowing how we even got to know each other or remember it.
Oh, but I mean, it was even yesterday that the form was filled out and you sent me the book and I read it, and I'm glad, because to be honest with you, the information you've shared today is gold, and that's why I'll get you back. I don't get many people back, but I'll definitely get you back, because I know that you were doing marketing for America Online and everything, so you must have a load of knowledge that you can share with people. And what I'll do is I'll put all the links in both the audio and the video, and when the book is released, you'll send me the link for that as well, and I'll make sure I'll include it. Obviously it'd be on your website, but just I like making it easy for people.
Awesome.
You said with the text, it all helps. So I thanks a million, Brandon.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. This has been really enjoyable.
Yeah, no problem. So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. As mentioned, we're on BitChute and YouTube. You'll find my 4 other podcasts, along with my coaching, buyer.link/podcaster. Sure to give us a thumbs up, 5-star rating, subscribe, share with your friends. And obviously, you've heard how good this gentleman is. So you check out his podcast and give him a 5-star rating as well. It all helps. Until next week, take care.